Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. American Express credit delinquencies rise in January. From Reuters in New York, American Express Company said last week that credit card delinquencies rose in January as job losses accelerated in the United States and the global economy deteriorated. In a regulatory filing, the company said the annual net charge-off rate, a measure of credit default, rose to 8.29% in January from 7.23% in December, while the rate for loans at least 30 days delinquent increased to 5.28% from 4.87%. American Express shares fell 10% to $14.16 in the afternoon trading on the New York Stock Exchange. The company's stock is down 23% this year, compared with a 45% decline in the KBW Bank Index. And from the Associated Press, the government provides $429 million to 29 more banks last week. The government says it has provided $429 million to 29 banks in the latest batch of investments under the $700 billion bailout program. The Treasury Department says the capital infusions bring the total amount the government has invested in banks to almost $200 billion. Former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson committed $250 billion of the first $350 billion in the financial rescue program to government purchases of bank stock. The largest investment in the latest round was $83.8 million to West America Bank Corporation, based in San Rafael, California. The smallest was $638,000 to Corning Savings and Loan Association in Corning, Arkansas. And from CNN, GM Chrysler file plans with the government asking for more money. GM seeks $16.6 billion, Chrysler $5 billion, and each would cut thousands of jobs. So from Detroit, General Motors and Chrysler asked the government for an additional $14 billion in aid, a dramatic acknowledgement that conditions in the U.S. auto industry have grown significantly worse in just 2 months. GM presented a survival plan that also calls for cutting a total of 47,000 jobs globally and across five more U.S. factories. That represents the largest workforce reduction announced by a U.S. company in the economic downturn. Chrysler said it will cut 3,000 more jobs and stop producing three vehicle models. Meanwhile, the United Auto Workers Union said it has reached a tentative agreement with Chrysler, GM, and Ford Motor Company on modifications to labor contracts. Such concessions were also a condition of the government bailout. GM said it could need up to $30 billion from the Treasury Department, up from a previous estimate of $18 billion. That includes $13.4 billion previously allocated and $9.1 billion in new loans. The world's largest automaker said it could run out of money by March without new funds. GM requests include a credit line of $7.5 billion to be used if the downturn in the auto industry is more pronounced than expected. but the automaker claimed it could be profitable in 2 years and fully repay its loans by 2017. Chrysler LLC requested $5 billion in new loans on top of the $4 billion it received in December. The company has said it might need an extra $3 billion. Both requests were part of restructuring plans the two automakers owed the government in exchange for earlier loans. Ford, which borrowed billions from private sources before credit markets tightened, has said it can make it through 2009 without government help. GM and Chrysler plan to reduce the number of models they offer to car buyers. GM last week said its Saturn brand could be phased out. The restructuring plans must be vetted by the Obama administration's new auto task. In a sign, the administration views the U.S. steel industry as a case study for revamping the auto industry. One of the task force's appointees played a key role in the reshaping of that industry earlier this decade. President Barack Obama's top spokesman told reporters aboard Air Force One on Tuesday that he wouldn't rule out bankruptcy for the Detroit automakers. The GM job cuts include 10,000 salaried and 37,000 blue-collar positions, amounting to 19% of its current global workforce of 244,500 people. A total 26,000 of the cuts will come from outside the U.S. The cuts would take place by the end of this year. The new plan has the U.S. workforce declining from about 92,000 hourly and salaried employees a year at year-end 2008 to 72,000 by 2012, about a 20% cut. GM Chairman and CEO Rick Wagoner said the plan submitted is more aggressive than the one presented to the government on December 2nd because the global economy and auto sales have deteriorated in the time that has passed since then. Today's plan is significantly more aggressive because it has to be, Wagoner told reporters. We have taken stronger actions. We need to. Chrysler had 54,000 employees at the end of 2008, so cuts would equal about 6%. The Michigan-based Chrysler said the economy and the market for new cars has deteriorated significantly since its initial request. Chrysler said it now projects that automakers will sell 10.1 million vehicles in the U.S. this year, the lowest level in four decades. Chrysler will eliminate the Dodge Aspen, the Durango, and Chrysler PT Cruiser, according to company president Jim Press. GM said it plans to sell or spin off its Saturn brand. If those attempts are unsuccessful, GM will phase out the brand. GM is also evaluating options for a sale of its Hummer division and so buyers for its Saab unit. Selling or eliminating those brands would leave GM to focus on Chevrolet, Cadillac, GMC, and Buick, with Pontiac reduced to one or two models. Details were unveiled on a day when President Barack Obama signed into law a massive economic recovery plan. Signs that the recession is deepening were more immediate for investors, however, and they dumped stocks and pushed oil prices sharply lower. The UAW said discussions are continuing regarding the union-run trust fund that will take on retiree health care expenses starting next year. Under terms of the government loans, both Chrysler and GM are required to reach concessions with the UAW and debt holders. These changes will help these companies face the extraordinarily difficult economic climate in which they operate, UAW President Ron Gettelfinger said in a statement released by the union. GM Chief Financial Officer Ray Young said the company hopes to exchange two-thirds of its roughly $28 billion in unsecured bond debt by the end of March. Bondholders, he said, signed a letter saying that they were making progress with the company. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, said she was hopeful the plans would help lead to the transformation of our domestic automobile industry into a viable, technologically advanced, and globally competitive manufacturing force. She said Congress looks forward to working with the Obama administration to make the domestic auto sector competitive while ensuring accountability to the taxpayers. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And in the second portion of our show, we get on to trying to help ourselves and trying to deal with not only the past debt problems, but to create a future for ourselves that is balanced, solid, and responsible. As always, I start out this segment of the show by giving a credit to Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work theories and books of these outstanding scholars. I highly recommend their books, All You're Worth, which is really the textbook for this segment of the show, and The Two Income Trap. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look at the Life in Debt section so you can catch up on all of the prior shows, which will give you a complete picture of what is needed to help get out of debt and to maintain your financial stability and to build a financially healthy future for yourself. So first, let's review what I discussed last week. We're in the area of love and money and dealing with relationships, those relationships being permanent marriage type or partner type relationships that really are on all levels of a relationship, from the monetary level, physical level, intellectual level, emotional level, egotistical level, and spiritual level, and they're really permanent commitments. And that's what is the basis for these kinds of thoughts that I'm discussing, that the relationship itself is a solid long-term commitment and not just a casual kind of living arrangement, where I've said very clearly that if that's the case, the money issues should be individualized and separate. In this kind of case, we're looking at the reality of money is there in the workings and how to deal with it so it actually ultimately gives something useful to that love relationship. Now, we came up with a number of golden rules, 8 golden rules, and last week I was speaking about rule number 5, which is keep money issues separate from the real stuff. We've gone over a number of different developmental problems, but this one is very important because sometimes money is the real problem in a relationship, but sometimes it isn't. Sometimes money is just the most familiar kind of fallback weapon available to fight over something which is really not the money issue. It's something different. It's just basically a weapon used to throw at your partner. So I gave a self-test, and the test is a true and false question test, and is it really about money? So I'll review that. Sometimes my partner buys expensive things for me to make up after a fight. My partner sometimes uses money as an excuse for not doing something nice for me, like going out for the evening or buying me a birthday present. No matter how a disagreement starts, it always ends up as a fight about money. I think an expensive gift is a good way to say, I am sorry. Money fights seem to come from nowhere. We're talking about something else and then suddenly we're yelling about money. Sometimes I spend money when I'm angry with my partner. And finally, sometimes I say we can't afford something when the truth is, I just don't want it. Now, if you've marked true for any of these statements, you and your mate do have some issues, even a problem, with substituting money for the real issues in your relationship. In relationships, there are, of course, honest emotions that can figure in even the best relationships. The problem isn't with the relationship, but sometimes something entirely different is coming up too. So it could be the relationship, or it could be something that has to do with the person's experiences outside the relationship, at work, in other relationships, family kinds of issues, worrying, anything that can bring stress into their lives outside of the relationship with their partner, with you, perhaps. And so it could be your honest emotions between each other, or it could be that there are some emotions that are being damaged or somehow inflamed from other sources. And there's no real magic formula to make those kinds of feelings go away. But substituting money for the real issues won't solve any of the deeper problem. Worse yet, it can create real source of new problems that just compound whatever else went wrong. So it is important to be careful to intellectually separate out these things, and then habitually to not throw in the money issues to deal with something that is deeper and different, emotional, that is based on a stress outside of the money kinds of stresses that we are all experiencing anyway. So if every conflict turns into a battle over your finances, try keeping the word money out of the quarrels. And that's a very important point, and I'll say it again. So try to keep money out of the quarrels if, in fact, it's not really about the money at all. And of course, we've talked about not battling about the money anyway, but there are ways to deal with the money issues separately, which we've been discussing all along. But when it has nothing to do with money, you certainly don't want to now take money as some kind of a weapon in the argument. Remember, you have made the decision to get your money in balance, and that's what this whole program has been about. That's why I've advised that you read the book All Your Worth. You are really trying to get on the road again to a brighter financial future. So you have, in this program, and if you followed the rules, then you've forgiven the past mistakes about money, and you've decided to put an end to the blame game, and you have agreed to give each other some free money in your wants category. And so there is no need to quarrel over little purchases. That's why we have that wants category there. And at the end of it all, there just shouldn't be very many money issues left for you to fight about. So you need to live life in a normal, natural, spontaneous way. And sometimes there's the real good, positive, upbeat side of laughter and liveliness and dancing and whatever. And then sometimes the stress side and even the conflictual side. But what we want is you to keep money out of that conflict. If money is no longer the first weapon in your arsenal, you get a better understanding about what is really wrong in that relationship on that issue, and you get a better chance to make things right about that. And then the other thing we did, we introduced last week, rule number 6, which is fight fair. And there are 4 basic points in the fight fair when money really is what you're fighting about. We just talked about it not being the issue, but when it really is the issue, you have to look at the reality that people do have different tastes and different priorities, and you may and can disagree with your mate's choice. That's if you're a normal couple in this world. So there are a number of ground rules which I introduced. Don't hit below the belt. Don't blame your partner for your joint decisions. Don't make giant generalizations. And don't take every difference as a personal insult. And we'll get to the details of that in a minute. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Okay, now let's go to Don't Hit Below the Belt. Our relationships, our partner in our relationships, can normally have something that is humiliating, something that is deep and a scar in their life, in their situations from the past, in your relationship, and it's related to money. Never ever use this to your advantage in a fight. In fact, you must never use that to your advantage. People are sensitive, people do have some scars, and you don't want to say something hurtful about that situation, even if it's related to money. So you don't bring up hurtful things when you fight over money. Those deep kinds of things that can very well be true. Even when you get mad, you have to set some limits. So don't hit below the belt. Don't make it so you're not going to leave room for growth between the two of you. The second point is don't blame your partner for joint decisions. And as a lawyer, I know that oftentimes one person in a relationship signing a contract has the commanding authority and is organizing everything, etc., etc. But from the legal perspective and from the real perspective in a relationship, if you sign it, if you agree, you haven't necessarily done all of the thinking and the homework and the activity that leads to creating that signature or that agreement, but you have signed, you have agreed. And once you have, it really is too late to attack your partner for getting that situation, that contract, which now may be a bad deal. The moment you agree to go along with it, you really forfeit the right to blame your partner if things don't work out as you had hoped or as was predicted. This is happening to everyone everywhere. If a joint deal goes south, then own up to your half of the bum decision. And that's something you just have to be honest about and you have to deal with. The next point is don't make giant generalizations. You can think that calling names or making sweeping statements like always, never, you always spend too much, you're never careful with money. These kinds of statements showing that whatever your mate did was dumb and it's always that way is not a good plan. Sweeping statements about how someone always overspends or is never careful, frankly, aren't true. They really are just parts of the total picture, but we focus in on them and we make them into Supreme Court cases, and they can transform something small into something big, making a mountain out of a molehill. And so the minor spat turns into then a raging battle. So you need to hold your tongue back, because once that tongue wags and the words come out, you cannot take those words back, and it goes out there and it harms and it damages the relationship. And then the fourth point is don't take every difference as a personal insult. People are different. We're not 100% compatible about money. That's just real. Money differences are not intended as the basis for attacks. If he doesn't want to spend a lot of money on fresh flowers, they just die is what he is thinking. It doesn't mean he doesn't love you. If, on the other hand, you think things are essential, for example, going out to dinner because you think you're a lousy cook, it doesn't mean that you don't love him, although he may think that. Sometimes money decisions are just about money, not an expression of your innermost spiritual relationship and soulful togetherness. And sometimes people just have these kinds of situations and it's just money. So you have to deal with that in a minimalized way, and it's not a personal insult. So you take the sting out of differences by recognizing they are just that, just differences, and we acknowledge the differences and we move on. Now, the seventh rule is divide and conquer. Financial equality means really sharing the decision making and sharing the responsibility in the decision making. It does not, however, mean that you have to share everything in terms of the workload or the chores equally. People have different temperaments, different traits, different talents. One can be organized, one may be disorganized, one is very number oriented and money oriented and possibly very intelligent with money, and the other can't even add properly, no less spend apparently in a proper way, and doubts quite a lot about spending and money. And one of you could be completely fascinated by finance, and the other really is nauseated by it. So in marriages that last for a long time, partnerships and relationships that have been ongoing for some time, these roles and realities tend to sort out on their own. But if people are in a new relationship, divvying up the chores can be a lot more complicated, especially if you're not married and your financial lives are really separate. So what we give is a few tips for dividing and conquering when money is mostly separate, because you're at that point in your life and relationships still. So point one is you start by dividing how much you will each contribute to the joint expenses. In a sense, this is going to be the same understanding for the balanced money formula that we've been talking about for months, and that is bare necessities and wants and savings, all of these three categories from the net monthly income. If one person's income is a lot higher or lower, it really doesn't matter if you're using this formula, because then their net monthly income is going to be 50% for bare necessities, 30% for wants, and 20% for savings, and then go over to yours and it's the same. So that's the basic fairness and easy kind of division for the relationship's finances. And then the next thing you do, the second point, is you decide how to divvy up the financial chores. Unmarried couples and partners often decide that since they're splitting the expenses 50-50 or so, they should split the chores 50-50. But you really have to be clear that financial chores are no different than all the other chores around the house. So if one partner turns green when faced with a checkbook, can't fight it. Just ask him or her to take out the garbage while you pay the bills. That's an important consideration. You take the chores that go with the strengths or lack of strengths. So instead of trying to split all the financial chores 50-50, divide the responsibilities in a way that really makes sense. If one is organized, then that person gets to keep the records. If the other one likes to negotiate, then that's the one that does the shopping for things that they can negotiate on. And if you are only willing to do what it takes to get your money into balance, then just do it. You're both 100% responsible, but you can't each do 100% of the tasks. You have to do what makes sense for you. And the final golden rule is learn the art of compromise. Of course, you're doing your honest to goodness best to have a happy, healthy money relationship. But even with that, you can still disagree on not just the little things, but the big things. The stuff you can't just cover with your wants money, your fun money, you know, the size of the house, the new car, all the really big decisions that can be the basis of some happiness, but also some disagreement, and no amount of good intentions can make them just go away. So what do you do then? The first major principle is that you have to communicate. You gotta talk. You just keep talking. You start talking, you keep talking, and you keep the conversation going, and that can take time. So you do it over time, and you look at consumer reports, you get data, you get information, you do research, you ask your friends about their similar kinds of purchases, and really you're bringing more information back to the table and opening the conversation to wider horizon of possibilities. Keep it open, keep talking, with the goal that you both feel 100% responsible for that final decision. That's really important. So we'll continue next week, and this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program.